Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, legislative Republicans voted to reinstate the work search requirement for Wisconsinites seeking unemployment benefits. Lawmakers postponed voting on directing state budget aid to broadband expansion grants after Governor Tony Evers committed to using $100 million in federal COVID relief aid for the effort. And GOP leaders rejected a new special session call from Evers to vote on a plan to expand Medicaid. Rewind, your week in review for May 21st.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Republicans this week sought to end enhanced unemployment pay and reinstate work search benefits. Top GOP lawmakers unveiled legislation to end Wisconsin's participation in federal programs to pay individuals an extra $300 per week in unemployment benefits. Evers has already told reporters that he would likely veto the bill. The announcement came in the days after Wisconsin House Republicans and U.S. Senator Ron Johnson asked Evers to end the extra benefits last week, citing a tight labor market. Some two dozen states have terminated the enhanced benefits, which run through September and raise the state's maximum weekly amount from $370 to $670 for an unemployed worker. Meanwhile, the Joint Committee for the Review of Administrative Rules voted to reinstate a requirement that those on unemployment do at least four work searches a week to remain eligible for benefits. That will begin on Sunday. The work search waiver was set to expire in July. These moves also come as the Department of Workforce Development announced the April unemployment figures. The Wisconsin unemployment rate last month was at 3.9%. Compare that to a year and a month prior, and Wisconsin's unemployment rate was 3.2%. So I guess the point here, JR, is the labor market was tight pre-COVID and is still tight now. Why is this issue returning to the forefront?
Two things. One, I mean, Republicans think it's good policy, right? They want to get people back to work. They're arguing this is a hindrance. And two, it's a messaging thing. Republicans don't like the latest COVID package that President Biden signed. They're making an argument that is a waste of federal money. It spends too much. And so this is part of the attack. I mean, that's not the right word, but the argument against ARPA, all right? So they're saying this is hindering our economy and not helping it. They're talking about inflation. They're talking about the bad, well, not great jobs report from last month. There wasn't many jobs created as they thought. We're going to be. So this is part of saying, hey, things aren't working because they're seeing polling that shows this is a popular package. And why wouldn't it be? People got thousands of dollars, right, in their bank accounts. So it helps make things popular. They're trying to find ways to kind of chip away at that. And this is one way to do it.
At the state level, though, Democrats, especially in JCRER this week, cited the lack of access to daycare and the fact that there are still school districts that are educating students either virtually or in a hybrid model as sort of barriers for parents to reenter the workforce or find different jobs. Is that an argument that you heard a lot as well this week?
No, absolutely. And you got to remember, too, I mean, Governor Evers is not going to go against a package that President Biden signed, right? I mean, they're from the same party. If you notice, the states that have turned down the enhanced federal benefits for unemployment are all run by Republicans. So until you see Democrats starting to turn on this, I don't see a lot of movement in Wisconsin because it's become a partisan issue.
Absolutely right. Let's move on now and hear from JCRER, where Representative Adam Nealon and State Senator Kel DeRoys talk about this issue.
I very much disagree with categorizing these work search requirements as onerous. You say you want to remain responsive to economic conditions. Please understand that's what we want as well. We're trying to be responsive to the conditions that are out there. And what we hear is that we need more workers. We need more people to enter into the workforce. And so our goal also in this is to remain responsive to economic conditions. And that's why we're here today.
I guess I just don't understand how people think that women, who are the ones who have really lost out in this pandemic, and many of whom, you know, are devastated by the loss of childcare and the loss of their working lives, are supposed to go back to work when the people who are in power are doing everything they can to totally ignore this childcare crisis. We can't really even have this conversation until we solve the childcare piece. You know, I think it is affecting just a huge number of people who want to go back to work but can't because they just can't get childcare, and even if they do get work, they can't afford it.
The Joint Finance Committee this week delayed action on broadband funding. The JFC co-chairs postponed a vote to direct state dollars toward broadband expansion grants and other broadband-related initiatives. Evers budget called for a $152 million increase in grants over the biennium and other broadband-related investments. Evers committed to using $100 million this week in federal COVID relief funds to cover the first round of broadband expansion grants through the Public Service Commission. Republicans now are using that to say that they are waiting until after June 1st to take up the issue in the budget. June 1st is when PSC will make applications and project eligibility guidelines available. On Thursday, though, the committee moved forward with voting to approve an extra $1.2 million for homeless and housing grants. That's a fraction of the investment that Evers called for in his budget. They also signed off on creating a deputy administrator for the Ethics Commission, agreed to raise lobbyist fees, and voted to use state instead of federal funding to fund three election commission positions. We haven't seen other details yet, JR, of Evers' plans for the ARPA dollars, the federal COVID relief dollars. But what do you make of the timing of this announcement this week, and when do you think we'll see more detailed information about how to spend this money?
Well, it plays into a bigger standoff between Evers and Republicans. Republicans want to know how Evers wants to spend every dollar of the federal money so they can build a budget around it. Evers wants to see how they're going to build their budget, so he knows what they're not going to do that he wants to do to try and supplement what his priorities are. And so we're kind of in this little cat and mouse game right now. Look at what Governor Evers wants to do. So first he announced in his budget $200 million in state money for various broadband expansion. Then he did the $100 million from what we know is coming in, right, from the ARPA money. Now he's also talking about a Medicaid expansion, that if you do the Medicaid expansion, there is federal money it draws down to pay for the coverage of 90,000 more people in Wisconsin. There's also, though, a $1 billion sweetener that would come with it for a one-time money. He laid out a whole host of projects this week that he would pay for with that money. That includes $200 million more for broadband. By the way, 200 plus 100 plus 200 is 500, which is how much Republicans want to spend in their broadband bill, right, from the federal money. One kind of side note about this discussion about broadband is that the federal money has more strings than the state money does. So there's a standard for broadband of upload and download speeds. So the state money can be used to do 25 megabytes per second for download speeds and 3 megabytes per second for upload speeds. That's the broadband definition. The federal money requires 100 and 100 unless it's not feasible for the 100 upload speeds, then 20 is okay. What that means is the federal money doesn't go as far as the state money does. So that's part of the kind of discussion for finance, because if you look at the Fiscal Bureau papers about broadband, we're at like 93% of Wisconsinites have access to broadband. It still would cost between $700 million and $1.4 billion to reach the last 7%. It tells you how expensive that last mile is of broadband, right? At the same time, around two-thirds of Wisconsinites actually subscribe to broadband or have the access. There's another issue. Even though it's there, people aren't paying for it because they maybe can't afford it. So how do you address that with this budget picture? That's the big deal. Getting that last mile laid down is going to be expensive and difficult to do. How do you make the federal money and state money work to get that done?
So is your assumption then that when JFC does meet on this and approve broadband expansion dollars, that they will be in the $200 million ballpark over the next biennium? Or do you think Evers' announcement changes that total at all?
I don't assume anything right now with how finance is operating, because I keep hearing the word slim, as in it's going to be a slim budget. Republicans keep saying that over and over again. It's going to be a slim budget, which means they're not going to spend a whole lot. We know broadband is a shared priority for Governor Evers and Republicans, one of the few things they actually agree on in the budget. I just don't know what the level of commitment is going to be with the federal money, because that federal money is quote-unquote free. So you might see Republicans keep pushing Evers to spend. Well, you want to do broadband expansion, you put federal money into it. You want to do all this stuff with education, well, we're going to do a smaller budget than what you wanted, but you can make up for it with the federal money you have. Because remember, Evers has sole discretion to spend that money right now because he vetoed their bills.
Speaking of education, JFC also announced this week that its meeting next week will focus on higher education, K-12. These are topics we typically see much later on in the budget process, right? But people I've talked to have noted the timing here, right? It's like the K-12 schools are still in session. This is an opportunity for Republicans to push the narrative about directing dollars, maybe, to right, districts that have prioritized in-person learning. Did you make anything of that timing, JR?
Oh, there's another big thing to remember. We have not seen the new revenue projections out of the Fiscal Bureau. So they're making this decision without knowing how much is in the till to spend the next 2 years. It suggests to people I talked to, a couple of things. One, Republicans have an idea in a number in their heads, a ballpark number, how much they're going to spend on K-12, and it's not contingent upon how much money there is to spend. After watching the Finance Committee for all these years, I always have seen K-12, the UW system, some areas like that come up last in the budget process because they want to fund everything else. Figure out, okay, how do they squeeze every last dollar into these education programs? Now it's more like, okay, they might sit on some money. They might put more money into a tax cut than what they're. I think those are the priorities than it is to fund education a higher number because there's so much federal money coming in. The question again goes back to how do you marry the federal money with the state money? There are definitely some Republicans I've talked to who don't want to put a lot more into education because they feel like there's so much federal money, especially going to Milwaukee, that how do you justify more state money going into education right now? Especially in districts that haven't been in person because Republicans feel like they have not provided an adequate education resource for kids. So that's going to play into this discussion on Thursday next week about, okay, you got this federal money, what about the state fund? What's a reasonable amount of state money to put into education? And oh, by the way, Governor Evers, no discussion about like, will he actually veto the budget? This is like one of his red lines, right? How much they put in education. And if they don't do as much as he wants to, does it reconfigure his plans for the federal money? Because in theory, he could dedicate those federal funds for education to make up for some of the stuff the Republicans don't do in the budget for K-12.
Exactly. Both sides are in the standoff, right, where they're playing chicken with each other a little bit, waiting to see who makes the first move and then reacting to that move, right, basically what we saw this week.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and we'll play out for the rest of the budget. Anyway, let's hear now from Senator LaTanya Johnson and Representative Amy Loudenbeck, who talked about homeless program funding in JFC this week.
Homelessness is not just an issue. It's not just a growing issue. It is a crisis in this state, especially for those low-income families. And we're sitting here on $5.5 million that should have been spent in the last budget that we haven't touched. Even if we don't have concern for the families that are facing eviction, we should at least have concern for those business owners who have just undergone a moratorium and cannot collect rent. That is money that could go to those landlords, prevent those families from having to worry about displacement, from having to worry about where their children are going to live. We could do that by addressing those issues today, getting that money out today, especially after we have just undergone the worst pandemic that this nation has ever seen.
Right now, we know that there was a significant investment made. We know that some of those funds have already been distributed, and we also know that a lot of new funding is going to be coming our way. But you know what? We're not going to create new programs in the budget. We're going to have ideas go to committee, and we're going to fund what we know is already working and what already is oversubscribed. If you want to give money to landlords to fix up their properties and rent them to people, you know, that's fine, but we didn't want to create a program to do that. We want to put money into assistance for people that are homeless and to give them an opportunity to, you know, to achieve stable housing and hopefully home ownership at some point. We're not just skipping over these things because they're not important. We're doing what we need to do at this committee level and leaving some of the other things for the normal legislative process.
Governor Evers this week called a special session on Medicaid funding. Evers wants lawmakers to accept federal Medicaid expansion dollars, something Republicans have already stripped from the budget. To put pressure on Republican lawmakers, Evers also announced $850 million in projects that would be covered by the extra $1 billion in one-time funds Wisconsin would get from accepting the expansion. That includes $200 million, as we previously discussed, to expand broadband, $100 million toward replacing lead pipes, and $100 million for local roads and bridges. Evers told reporters this week, quote, if the Republicans decide not to do this, they'll be turning away projects in their own districts. Well, within a couple hours, Republican leaders rejected the plan. Majority Leader Jim Steinke and Senate President Chris Kapinga said in a statement, quote, this is a thinly veiled political maneuver by the governor. We intend to gavel out this unserious stunt. Special session, I should note, was called for Tuesday, and lawmakers are not required to take up or act on the plan. J.R. Evers has been focusing on Medicaid expansion in recent weeks. We saw he was very vocal about its removal from the budget. He's insisted repeatedly that GOP leaders bring to him a plan to expand Medicaid in order for him to meet with them and tell them about how he'll spend the ARPA dollars. What is Evers' strategy here?
Good question. It seems to be trying to put public pressure on Republicans to come around to his view. The problem for the governor is that the districts Republicans represent aren't very swingy. They're not getting pressure back home. Now, granted, we're going to have new maps for 2022, so who knows what they look like? Who knows who's going to draw them? But Republicans aren't getting heavy pressure about this. And don't forget, too, yes, Medicaid expansion is popular, so is marijuana legalization, but find me 10 voters who will die on a hill to have Medicaid expect. That's their driving vote, right? It's kind of like a lot of things in that governors push out that are popular, like redistricting reform, right? Like having a nonpartisan commission, people like that idea. They think it's appealing. I don't find many people, others who are very passionate about it, who are like, that drives my vote on everything that I do. Same with Medicaid expansion. Yes, it's popular. People like the idea of it, but that's not driving the political discussion among people outside of the Capitol bubble. So the governor's just not found a way to pressure Republicans to come around to his way of thinking. When I've talked to people, said he'd be better off trying to reach out to leadership and saying, Republican leaders said, okay, what do you need? I need to have Medicaid expansion. What are you willing to give up or get? What can I give you to get this, right? Robin Voss is online and saying he's not getting Medicaid expansion. But Robin loves to negotiate. That's his reputation. He loves the give and take of the Capitol arena. Evers not engaging him. Without engaging him, you can't try and get something out of him and give him something in return. So I don't see, at this point, talking to lawmakers, both sides of the aisle, they don't see this change in the discussion.
Yeah, negotiating via letter clearly isn't working for leaders in the state. So unless someone picks up the phone or answers an email, I suppose.
Now, in theory, you get new maps next year and Evers can go district to district and campaign on this issue. Maybe, but that's a year and a half away. Doesn't help this budget. Doesn't change the dynamic of this budget discussion.
Absolutely. Moving on to our next and final topic, we're sort of batting cleanup from last week. Had some breaking news following our recording. The state Supreme Court rejected a redistricting request from conservatives. The court declined a request from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and former Speaker Scott Jensen to create a new process to funnel redistricting lawsuits before justices. But the court stressed the move wasn't indicative of its potential involvement in future redistricting challenges. The order said, quote, it remains well settled that redistricting challenges often merit the court's exercise of its original jurisdiction. Federal courts, which drew the lines in 2002, have largely handled suits concerning redistricting. And under the current state of divided government, redistricting is, of course, likely to end up in the courts again. Anything stand out to you about this order, JR?
A couple of things. One, some background here. So in 2002, which I was a newish reporter in the Capitol at the time, what happened was there were competing lawsuits that were filed over redistricting. The federal case was kind of farther along. Supreme Court at the time, because that case is farther along, we're going to defer the feds. But we believe redistricting should be a state court issue, and we're going to talk about a process to handle these lawsuits going forward. Because justices of the Supreme Court aren't map drawers. That's not their expertise, right? They had a discussion, came to a conclusion, we're not going to put a process in place. Now, 10 years ago, when I wasn't a news reporter in the Capitol anymore, Republicans drew the maps, didn't have a question. This time around, we think it's going to the courts. Basically, all the Supreme Court says, we're not taking first whack at this, automatically. They still could. But often in the court system, you go lower courts first, circuit court, maybe the appeals court sometimes, then the Supreme Court. We've gotten away from normal order with the Wisconsin court system where conservatives in particular have gone to the Supreme Court directly on big issues saying, it's going to get here anyway, you take it up now. What happens, though, is that you don't develop a record. And that's what circuit court trial is for, develop a record, and the Supreme Court then can review that. All this means is they're not necessarily saying they're going to take it for sure. It leaves the door open to going to circuit court first. The Supreme Court could take original jurisdiction, and the federal courts could end up with redistricting too, because you could, if you're going to file a suit over a map, go to the feds first and try and beat some of the state courts and get there. Now, the question has been, who wants to be in what court? For a long time, Democrats argued to me that they were better off the federal courts because a three-judge panel a couple of years ago ruled the old map, it's a current one, was a partisan gerrymander. It was illegal. U.S. Supreme Court said, we don't belong in those discussions, so let's just not do that. And the Supreme Court has, state Supreme Court has a 4-3 conservative majority. So Republicans are like, okay, we should go there. Well, Brian Hagedorn is now like kind of the wild card in everything. And I've actually had some Republicans argue to me that maybe it's not the best place to go because they don't feel that they're assured of a quote-unquote good result. So it's going to be interesting to watch who goes where and how quickly they get there. Other thing to keep in mind, we still have until September 30th, I think, is the final details of the data to draw maps. Look, the computer programs are so good anymore, you could draw a map in a day. You could pass it in a day and a half, you know, in theory. The challenge is going to be the court system and how quickly they go through the courts. Because even if the state Supreme Court draws the map or signs off on one after a circuit court approves one, it'll go to the federal courts anyway. There will be a challenge, I am sure, of some way, shape, or form. Well, I should say I'm sure, but I would bet you money a good chance of a challenge of the state Supreme Court map in the federal courts and be another whack there. Oh, by the way, papers can be circulated April 15th of 2022. So that's the question. Will we have lines drawn and finalized before April 15th of next year?
Yeah, that's the deadline we're facing, isn't it? And it's interesting to think about because usually this data is available for states as of 2 months ago, March. Mm-hmm. So we are facing a really, really compressed timeline to get all of this done and through the courts in time for spring of next year.
Which was another argument that conservatives made about having the Supreme Court establish its rules process was that it would speed up the process and get the court, get the issue for the justices right away. They could have a decision out. Then if there was that appeal to federal courts, it could all be worked out by April. You may see a circumstance where the window circulating nomination papers has to be pushed back a bit. It wasn't that long ago that the filing deadline was 6 weeks later. Like it was June 1st when you could start, right, in mid-July before you had to be done. That was with a September primary. Now we have August primary. So the window could get compressed. There is still time to have lines in place for next fall. But I've heard the theory that maybe you have one more election cycle under the current map. I don't think we're there yet. But, you know, that theory's out there.
There's a bunch of wild rumors circulating. I'm not sure if it's worth entertaining all of them at this point. But I think the one other, I guess, differentiator in this process compared to past redistricting cycles is, you know, Evers People's Maps Commission. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're going to propose their own lines as well. This quote-unquote nonpartisan commission of sort of residents of each of the 8 congressional districts. But it's unclear, you know, if they are proposed as a bill by Democrats in the legislature, they're going to be dismissed by Republican majorities, right? Where these maps could come into play, though, is in the court process, right? They could be proposed as an alternative to the Republican-drawn maps, and perhaps a court would consider them, perhaps a court would decide to implement them. Are you watching for that, too, in this process?
To build off of your point, what does the State Democratic Party of Wisconsin do? Because obviously Evers is a Democrat. This is his baby, the People's Commission. Does the state party say that's our map we're going to support? Because this map is supposed to be a competitive one based on these, you know, various principles of like trying to make, you know, it fair. Do Democrats say, no, we think we should draw a map that's good for us? Because the court, again, they're not map drawers. They're going to take these suggestions and maybe move some lines, but that's not their expertise. Do you risk not having a good Democratic map and make the people's map look like the Democratic map? Because then you could see a scenario where the Republican map is over here, the people's in up here where the Democrats want to be here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on top of that, Republicans, what do? Do they draw a map that's really, really partisan, kind of like what we have right now? During the oral arguments about that rules process, a lawyer for Republican leadership said, whatever you guys do with a map in the end should look pretty much like the one we have right now, because the last one approved by lawmakers. I don't know that Democrats would appreciate that happening, right? But if you're Republican, do you draw a quote-unquote fairer map to try and butter up the justices to say, hey, here, we brought this more reasonable map in here that's more competitive, so you should think about that one.
Yeah, there's so much to watch for in the coming months, and we'll be here to break it down. But let's move on to stocks now. What's rising this week, Chair?
Ben Wickler, so state party chair for Democrats. He will be unchallenged in their 2-year term at the June convention. Not a surprise. I mean, look at his record in statewide elections for the last year and a half, unblemished. He raised a ton, and I mean a ton of money as state party chair. The only real kind of issue to bring up is that all that money did not translate into wins at the legislative level last fall. Fast forward to next year, it'll be a different environment for Ben Wickler to run in or to run campaigns or help campaigns in, because you're going to have the party in power in the White House is yours. Challenging environment. You have to defend the Evers record, rather go on offense against Donald Trump. And you have legislative races. Now, you also have a Senate campaign, a contested primary you have to kind of navigate. It's going to be interesting to watch how he navigates that entire terrain, and it's going to be a much different environment for him in terms of where they put money, decisions that they make, versus 2020 with Donald Trump in the White House. The one thing I heard from Democrats this week was that while Donald Trump is kind of gone and he drove a lot of things for Democrats last year, Ron Johnson has become like a little bit Trump-lite, or he's leaned at least to MAGA world quite a bit. Ron Johnson is a great way to keep raising money for Democrats because they had Donald Trump the boogeyman last year. Now Ron Johnson's assumed that role. The longer Ron Johnson takes to make up his mind about running again, the easier it is for Ben Wickler to raise money for 2022.
Mm-hmm. What's mixed this week?
So a lobbyist, the Ethics Commission has argued that needs a new deputy administrator position because there's been an increase in number of complaints and requests for guidance. To do that, they wanted to increase lobbying fees by $55. So you pay a fee, I think it's $375 to register if you're a principal. Then you pay $125 per lobbyist that you have per session. They want to add $55 to both of those fees to fund this administrator. Joint Finance said, no, we'll do $10, which is not a whole lot of money. One joke I heard this week is that lobbyists spill more drinks worth $10 in a single function than they need to worry about, but that's besides the point. But the point is they're going to not have a huge increase. It's the first increase in 28 years. They're going to have, oh, by the way, Finance, continue with this theme of not wanting to add jobs to the state workforce, is taking a position already on the ethics staff and moving that, basically the deputy's job.
Yep, exactly. And we saw a letter from DOA Secretary Joel Brennan asking that the body try to preserve those positions that have been left vacant or unable to be hired, or part of that hiring freeze over the course of this last year. Is that position part of that, or is that not part of it? Or
I don't believe that's part of the freeze. Okay. So it's interesting, though, about the letter from Brennan is that he's saying quit cutting these jobs. But remember we did the standard budget adjustment? So it's a housekeeping move, basically. You have, they're called project positions in state government, where they're funded by a certain grant or whatnot. Some of them expire. So every agency has a standard budget adjustment, every budget to kind of like adjust that stuff. Republicans, the Joint Finance Committee, did one big giant standard budget adjustment motion, right? It cut 235 jobs. They're vacant. They're either vacant or expiring or whatnot. Most of those jobs have been cut under the governor's budget too, because of the standard budget adjustment. So they still have cut like 257 so far, FTEs. But the point is that it's kind of like a warning shot, like please don't cut more jobs because we plan to fill them again, because this freeze is not supposed to be permanent. But there are jobs that were going to go away, again, because they kind of don't, I know it sounds kind of crazy, but they don't really exist. They kind of expire or they're not being used. But yes, that's definitely an issue that DOA is raising, the Evers administration, that okay, don't keep doing this because we want to fill these jobs again. We're getting back to normal. We hope to have people in these jobs.
Interesting. I didn't realize those dynamics. Thanks for filling me in. And what's falling this week, Darren?
So Josh Call, look, there was a division administrator at DOJ that filed a complaint last month about two different people at DOJ that it's a race-based and sex-based complaint that she's being paid less than her peers because she's black and a woman. Number one, you don't want a complaint like that filed no matter what workforce you're overseeing, right? Number two, issues of race and gender are very sensitive right now. Number three is the election next year. That's not a great combination to have this coming out now. Now, there are a couple of things to watch with Call and how he responds to this. One, what happens to the two DOJ employees that are the center of the complaint? Are they disciplined? Do they go away? They let go? Do they leave the agency? Number two, there is an investigation that was conducted that Call said, hey, we went out and got this outside perspective of what's going on. How quickly can they release those records to show what the conclusion was? They've argued that the complaint was not justified from what they found. The faster those records out, people argue to me, the better it is for Call to put this behind him and move on toward 2022.
Thanks, JR, and thanks everyone for tuning in. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
And that's Rewind, your week in review for May 21st.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.